Yvonne? She's there. Is Yvonne supposed to be doing this? Is Yvonne supposed to be doing this?
May I have your attention, please?
Oh,
may I have your attention? Good evening, everybody. My pleasure to introduce this session to you. And unfortunately, we're starting late. I have been kind of hesitant to say it's our mistake, but hopefully you will forgive us for the delay and starting this program. The next session will be the treatment of women in Christianity and Islam. And I'll be the moderator for this session. My name is Hamid Ghazali. This session will have 10 minutes presentation instead of 15 minutes, since we have more discussions involved. We'll have 10 minutes presentation by each side. And then we'll have 14 minutes of interactive dialogue, and then 40 other minutes the discussants will come over here and make comments and interact with the rest of the panelists, and then we'll have the audience participation in the last half an hour. We have in the session on the Christian side, Dr. Lewis Leslie, who is a professor of Christian ethics and dean of the doctoral program at McCormick Theological Seminary, author of several books and papers, among which A Christian Vision of Sexual Justice, Theological Reflections on Violence Against Women, Woman, Power, and Politics. And there are a couple of other books. If you're interested, you can talk to her, and we'll be happy to give you a piece of paper that includes all the biography about her. And then we also have Sister Jean Youth. She's working for the 8-Day Center for Justice, working on human rights issues. She has a B.S. from Siena High College, an M.A. in Systematic Theology from Aquinas Institute. She's an educator and a community organizer. She's an Adrian Dominican sister. She lived and worked for 17 years in Latin America, and we're glad to have her with us today. On the Muslim side, we have Sister Aisha Bey on our extreme left over here. She's a teacher at Al-Ghazali Islamic School in New York. She has a master's degree in comparative literature from Pennsylvania State University and taught in high school for 2 years in Turkey and 5 years in Germany. She's working on a master's degree in comparative religion. She's comparing Islamic law to Western law and issues pertaining to women. She's a Muslim since 1985, and you will find her experience unique for the topic that we are discussing today. And then we have Dr. Jamal Badawi with us over here, who is a professor at St. Mary's University in Halifax, Canada. He has extensive experience in religious dialogue. He's a producer of more than 200 TV programs on Islam. These programs are aired almost all around the Muslim world. He's the president of the Islamic Information Foundation, member of the FIC, or the Islamic Law Council of North America, which is the highest authority in terms of giving Islamic verdicts in different Islamic issues, and taught courses on Islam in several universities. He's also an author of several papers on Islam, among which are The Bridge Building Between Christianity and Islam and Women in Islam. We will start with the presentation from the Muslim side. If you please come in, Sister Aisha. You have to speak aloud. Okay. I'll give you that one for now. That one. Keep it in there. I'll be around watching over. I don't like to stand still in the podium. You can get me.
As I began to contemplate the short presentation for this particular dialogue, I was first beset with the problem of exactly what I could say in the midst of scholars whom I personally admired for quite a while and whose books and articles I have frequently read. Certainly, I can't contend with their scholarly expertise nor with their ability to read and to comprehend Arabic, most especially the language of the Quran. But I do have a perspective on this particular issue of women in Islam that I'm quite sure my other distinguished colleagues don't have. At least I don't think so. I was a Christian and a secular humanist for more than 30 years before I converted. Therefore, I can speak, at least personally, about the influence of Christian thought and belief upon the life of a person raised in a very conservative Christian fundamentalist home, a home in which the literal authority of the Bible was not only believed but practiced and firmly taught. I memorized Bible verses, read church commentary, theology through most of my life. I questioned and debated heatedly with my grandfather, the church elders, my Sunday school teachers, and anyone else in earshot about my personal doubts and questions concerning God, who he was, what he was, the accuracy of the Bible, the mystery of the Trinity, and the mystery of countless other philosophies that I did not understand. I was termed a difficult child and was pronounced by my grandfather bound for hell before I was in second grade. After my conversion, 1985-86, when I began to understand what the Quran was about, I really decided that Allah knew what he was talking about when he said that we are born a Muslim and it is our parents who make us a Jew or a Christian. Because what Islam was able to do for me was to give a concrete foundation to many things I had thought or suspected were probably true, but nobody ever told me about. Islam answered the questions that I had and answered them in a very rational type of package. I think the most significant point to make about the rights of women in Islam is that they are God-given. They are specifically stated in very direct terms in the Holy Quran, as revealed by Allah. I do not have to decide generally which church fathers to follow, or who to interpret, or who hated women less, or which one was proven wrong later on. God has said what I can do, what I should not do, and what I'm accountable for. And I'm not accountable for anything else. So I do not carry the guilt of the world upon my shoulders. I don't need a mortal man to decide for me, to restrict me, or to liberate me. It has been done more than 1,400 years ago. Before I get specific about these rights, let me stop here momentarily and make a point very clear. And this was a point that Dr. Bedawi brought up earlier this morning. While God has granted women their rights in the Quran and the Prophet, peace be upon him, has further clarified them in the Sunnah, it remains true that throughout the world, often Muslim men and women are guilty of being ignorant about those rights or being unaware that what they practice is cultural tradition, not Islam. Therefore, this cultural tradition is open to debate, it's open to criticism, and even rejection if it is not in line with the Quran and the Sunnah of the Prophet. The fact remains, however, that as long as a woman can stand by the Quran and by the Sunnah, she can defend her rights, and she has them. They cannot be taken away. If they're taken away, she has the right to fight to get them back. In defense, however, of my Muslim brothers, I would like to point out that despite the dominant image in many parts of the Middle East of what I would call cultural paternalism, cultural patriarchy, and all of the rest, I would never conceive the possibility that any group of imams or sheikhs or other religious officials would ever convene a council, as was done in Macon in 585, to discuss whether or not we women were homo sapiens, whether we had a soul, whether we were an inferior breed, an afterthought of God. When this council was convened, they did vote to allow women to remain homo sapiens, although of a lesser inferior kind. I do not ever expect that that would happen in Islam. I could not conceive that men would even begin to think upon those terms. Perhaps the most significant right granted to women in Islam is equality. And this equality is spiritual, physical, economic, and intellectual. Allah has revealed in Surah Ali Imran, "Never will I suffer to be lost the work of any of you, be he male or female, your members one of another." In Surah Nisa, "If any do deeds of righteousness, be they male or female, and have faith, they will enter heaven, and not the least injustice will be done to them." In contrast to this, Christian biblical inferiority is taught from the time of creation. And I noticed that one of the panelists this morning brought up Genesis 1, that we were all created male and female in the image of God. This is Genesis 1. Genesis 2, however, tells us that woman was created after Adam had named the animals, and God decided he was alone and needed a helpmate. He was then put to sleep, and a rib was removed from him, and woman was made. Therefore, and most church fathers have interpreted, including Aquinas and Augustine, that we are a lesser. We were not created first. We were not created simultaneously. And some church fathers have followed Aristotle's original idea that woman is an imperfect form, quote, a misbegotten male. This has not occurred in Islam. We have been created equal with equal obligations and responsibilities, the only exceptions being certain things that we are not obligated to do equally with the men, such as faithful attendance at the Jumu'ah Friday prayers. But we are obligated to make the prayers, and we are obligated to follow all Quranic injunctions. Another right of great significance is the right to divorce, a right still argued about in many Christian denominations and still debated strongly within the Roman Catholic Church. In Surah Baqarah, in verses 228 through 232, and I don't want to take the time to read all of them, Allah has clarified the points of divorce for men and women, granting women equal rights to divorce should there be cause to do so, meaning should she fear cruelty from her partner, or they simply cannot get along, and it is better to part amicably than to live together miserably. The point that I want to emphasize here is that women do have this right, and it has been granted from the very first revelations in Islam. The right is greatly discussed in the hadith of Muslim, Bukhari, and Dawood. The concept is that divorce is hated by God, and yet is permitted because Allah is wise and knows that sometimes we humans suffer many frailties, and it is better for us to part than to be miserable. My personal experience in this area still is very, very strong in memory. My mother divorced an alcoholic, abusive husband in the year of 1953. She returned home to her father, who to his dying day considered her an adulteress and not worthy of entrance into his church because she had remarried. He quoted to her Matthew 19, verses 3 to 9, in which Jesus said that anyone who marries a divorced woman is guilty of adultery. And, of course, for the woman also, if she remarries. Another point of matter debated between Christian and Muslim, or between Muslim and non-Muslim in particular, is the dress code. And I realize here that I'm getting into more social issues than scriptural, but I'm sure Dr. Bedawi can take care of scriptural references if we need them. The social issues I'm very familiar. Both many surahs comment upon the dress code of the Muslim female and detail many of the facts. The major concern, it seems, in the West is the wearing of the hijab or the scarf, not the veil. I believe when I first converted, this was one of my major problems. There are commands given to us in Surah 24 to properly cover ourselves when we go abroad and when we go out. The commands are given to us in the Quran to lower our gaze and to be modest. We do not wear the hijab or the scarf as a symbol of our husband's authority over us. And I would like to make that very clear. This is not an Islamic concept. As a matter of fact, the concept of a woman covering her head as a part of a concept relating to authority of a male is taught by Paul in the first letter to the Corinthians in chapter 11. And he says, "For a man ought not to have his head veiled, since he is the image and reflection of God. But woman is the reflection of man. Indeed, man was not made from woman, but woman from man. Neither was man created for the sake of woman, but woman for the sake of man. For this reason, a woman ought to have a symbol of authority on her head." Islam does not tell us to cover our head because we need a symbol of authority to remember anything. It is a point of modesty, and it is a point for Muslim women to recognize one another. I can assure you, when I walk in an airport, the first thing I look for is the hijab on somebody who's there, I hope, to pick me up. All right. Another thing I would like to raise that is always brought up to us is the idea of polygamy and the issues of feminism. Polygamy is not an Islamic convention that is singular only to Islam. It also has existed in Christianity, has existed in Judaism. Unless the Christians want to deny the lives of their own prophets, we have Abraham, we have many of the prophets who had more than one wife, and their children have all been recognized. Martin Luther, the great reformer himself, stated, "I confess for my part that if a man wishes to marry two or more wives, I cannot forbid him, nor is his conduct repugnant to the Holy Scriptures." He himself asked for permission to marry a second wife while his first wife, Margaret of Savoy, was alive. A synod of reformers, six of them, approved and said that the Bible does not condemn polygamy, therefore it was approved.
Sister Aisha, we'll discuss polygamy in more detail. Okay. I would kindly ask you to...
Well, I was asked to
cover... Start because you're running out of time.
On the issue of feminism and religion, I would like to say something here. I have been told by many Muslims that being a feminist is haram, it's wrong, it's a violation. I disagree.
Well, thank you very much. I think we'll stop at this point. Thank you. Would you please have the presentation? Dr. Lewis?
We're going to try to split this up 5 minutes apiece. So, and I'm going to start. First, I think I should say that... Is this on?
Yeah. Hmm? This is for recording. This is for the...
Okay. You all can hear me?
Yeah.
I think first I should say that to talk about the Christian view of women or the treatment of women or the rights of women is probably very difficult to do. There are traditions distinguished here not only between Protestant and Catholic, but within each of those traditions and many others, quite a diversity of views. Some of that has to do with a diversity of approaches to understanding Scripture among people trying to understand Scripture with respect to the issues of the treatment and rights of women. There's a considerable debate among Christian feminists about the interpretation of Scripture and what it means, and let me say at least three different approaches that often come together in many of us that are working, but that I would like to distinguish very briefly. One of them is represented by a number of Christian scholars. I would name Letty Russell and Rosemary Ruther among them. Look at the gospel, at what I sometimes call the big story, the sort of most important aspect of Scripture, the story of the gracious sovereignty of God shown to us, redeeming us, and calling us to discipleship, and look at the other texts, particular texts about women, in relation to that dominant story of God's gracious love and rule. And it gives them a way of, in a sense, prioritizing among texts, and we'll probably get into some discussion of the appropriateness of that. There are some other feminists, and I think of Phyllis Trible on texts of terror, who have looked at specific, often neglected texts. In this case, she takes up the texts that have to do with violence against women. and tries by taking a careful look again at those texts to show forth a sometimes neglected message of God's graciousness also, or God's wisdom with respect to these texts that we never pay any attention to. And sometimes it's just the stories of historically the way women have been treated. The third one may be related to something John Falikowski talked this morning when he said, we not only look at Scripture, but we look at tradition, we look at the interpretation of Scripture within the community of faith, within the life of the church. A former colleague of mine, Kathy Sackenfeld, talks about authority and community. And she really takes her cues from Acts 15, which is the story of the Council of Jerusalem. It's a story in which the council, all the sort of New Testament greats gathered about the question of whether the Gentiles, whether the newly converting Christians would have to be circumcised like the Jews. And in a way, they came to a very radical conclusion, the conclusion that the Gentiles who convert to Christianity would not have to be circumcised. It was a radical decision that the church took in council. And Kathy is suggesting that we read the Bible not as individuals, kind of in the privacy of our study alone, but that we read it in the community with one another. We read it with attention to voices not often heard, and that out of that we will have a truer view, a more important understanding of the status of women in the community than if we just take random texts about one thing or another. That probably does my time. Let me say three things very briefly about themes I think that we can take from Scripture and that might be important for our discussion. One has to do with what I'm more familiar with in the theological tradition than in Scripture. It's called the good of marriage. From Augustine through the tradition, Christian thought has always understood the twin goods of companionship or friendship as well as childbearing and childrearing. And they understood early on that friendship, they had after all read Aristotle, that friendship implied equality, though it was very different for the church fathers as it was to hold that when they culture believed so deeply in subordination. So we have a very mixed tradition, I think, with respect to marriage and to the relations between men and women more generally. Secondly, if you take Galatians 3:28, in Christ there is neither slave nor free, male or female, Jew or Greek, in a very fundamental text in the New Testament, you have the claim that ultimately, whether we're male or female, is not the crucial issue. And we get back then to our discussion of the doctrine of creation and human rights and the way in which all of us, male and female, share in the claims about human rights. And finally, I sometimes, in my real radical moments, say, what we have to remember, especially about the New Testament, is that it is not a story of the family, but a call to discipleship. And you can quote Jesus all over the New Testament saying, who are my mother? Who is my mother? Who are my brothers? Those that do the will of God. And so what is crucial as we talk about relationships, whether we're talking about family or other relationships between men and women, is that in this tradition, the important thing is the way is faithfulness, is discipleship. It's not entirely determined by gender or gender relations.
I hope everybody will do the same as you, being so generous in saving the time.
Does she get a word in at all? No.
I think we'll give you a credit for that.
Dr. Valerie and Sister Aisha, I think we will start the first point in the discussion, which is comments and reactions to the points presented.
At this point, do you have any comments on the presentation of Dr. Lewis?
I don't have a problem. I've been talking with her now for about an hour and a half. I have no problem with what she's talking about as far as reading the New Testament for voices that have not been heard. My major point has been that women throughout the world have been disregarded and denigrated for thousands of years. The difference, I know that there are many good Christian women involved in women's activities and groups. I have worked with them for many years, and I'm in full support of their objectives. As part of this dialogue, however, I think the point is, at the bottom line, that in Islam, these things that Western women have had to fight for centuries, and many of the laws have not been changed until the last 8 to 10, 15 years, as regarding women's property rights, women's economic rights, security, etc., were granted by God in the Quran to women as early as the years between 615 and 620. By the death of the Prophet, peace be upon him, in 623, they were well established, and the Quran was compiled and written. It was there 1,400 years ago. I think this is a remarkable achievement to have had this in writing and to have it revealed and explicitly stated. It is not a matter of tradition. This is a matter of God. This is divine revelation. This is not even Sunnah. The Sunnah explains how this should work, but the revelation, these rights were given already by God. All the Prophet, peace be upon him, did was to explain how to put them into effect. This is a very different situation than with the Christian authority, in which the professor had said earlier, tradition, church teaching, often supersedes or overrides revelation. This, I think, has caused a great deal of difficulty in the West, because this is man-made. This is man overruling what God has declared to be.
Sorry to interrupt you, but we still have 2 hours, and I think I'll stop you between now and then when you exceed a certain limit of time. So please help me make your comments as short as possible. This is a dialogue, and we have to remember that. So forgive me for stopping you. I misunderstood that you had a presentation and you wanted to add something. I'm sorry.
I thought you were already done with
your presentation. No. So we can, make up for what was left.
That's fine.
If you have any comments about what she said, or you want to add to the presentation, you're most welcome, please.
No, I'd like to respond to Sister Aisha. I think it's pretty spectacular too that Islam has had this in writing for these many years. I think one of the fundamental differences, and I came to this dialogue with the intention of learning from you and hoping that you would hear us too. I mean, there are no expectations that anybody's going to convert. I think that what is important to me is to share the struggle too, as a Christian and as a woman. And I think that yes, you have had this literature, and Christian women have not. That Christian women have been that the Jewish Testament and later on the New Testament. We understand our scriptures to have been written by communities of people to express their relationship with God. And whereas we talk about it as divine revelation, I'm beginning to feel we don't mean the same thing by those words as you do. We mean that we understand that communities have these experiences of God. You know, here are the Jews, this little ragtag group of people. They're not even an ethnic group. They're escaping from Egypt. They join with other nomadic tribes. They come together. And so they tell their story. But they tell their story in a cultural context. And the cultural context of the day was that women were property. The cultural context of the day, the socio-historical reality of not of the Jews. They had kind of an egalitarian democratic process because they were all from all over, but they had come from years and years and years of patriarchal, monarchical models. And so these are the models, that these are the socio-historical realities of our tradition. And in these socio-historical realities, women are second-rate citizens. And this is how it is played out. So I come today to say that, you know, whereas we have worked toward, we have three things, I think, and this may be true for both of us. We have a body of conflicting literature, which you do not have. You seem to understand just exactly what God is saying at every minute of the... I mean, you really do, are very much clearer about God's will for you. And we are always discovering God's will for us. We are always not reinterpreting outside of a context, a theological framework, but we are always in an application kind of mode. The second thing is we have a history of tradition as it is witnessed and practiced. And I think this is where we also differ from you. What I heard doctors say this morning was that if people are not living fully and completely and perfectly is the Islamic tradition, then you tend to say, well, that's not Islam. We tend to say, if people call themselves Christians, well, we're stuck with one another. I mean, we may not be perfect. We may have done some really seedy things like the Inquisition and the Crusades, but nevertheless, it was Christianity. So there's another point in which we explain ourselves differently. And it is in this kind of adherence, the different cultural context, that we have to see the struggle of women, I think. We have to understand that women have been symbolically idealized in our literature and tradition and have been made to feel guilty or unnatural for rebelling because they were not treated like full human beings. Women have been symbolically idealized in many cultural contexts for thousands of years, but indeed have not been treated as equals with the men in their society. And so for that reason, I do not see any difference between talking about the development of human rights for women or human rights for minorities, or human rights for racial groups, or human rights for those that are colonized by militaristic governments. It's all the same issue. It's an issue of power and control, and it's how the dominant society organizes itself to maintain that control.
Thank you. Any comments?
I agree completely. I have absolutely no argument with your definition from scriptural authority. My point is that when I was raised up, and I don't know what denominations the two of you belong to, but the denomination I was raised in did not view the Bible as a history of community, as the history of a people reacting to one another and placing women within a context. I absolutely agree. That's been my basic argument, that the Bible is a history of community, and it hasn't been exactly my community. Therefore, I am not subject to that particular community's way of looking at things as a woman. I agree completely. However, my grandfather would have me in hell and burning forever for saying such a thing, because to him the Bible was from cover to cover, from the very first letter to the last letter of Revelation, divine revelation, authority, every comma, period, for all 60 versions of it. Absolutely accurate. And therefore, there was, you know, you were bound by that. I have no problem with more ecumenical view. None whatsoever. In fact, I think you're right, completely. It, however, is not the opinion of about 50 million of Christian right now.
Okay, thank you. Okay, well, I think we have a few. I'm sure you have lots to say, no doubt. Especially after certain things are said and so on. But I'd like to stay on the main issue. We're not discussing, is the Bible God's word? Or is the Quran God's word? So I would kindly ask you to stick to the topic, though this has some relevance to what we're discussing. But please, keep looking at this sheet of paper. That's what we're going to go with.
I don't have that sheet of paper.
I'm sorry.
You didn't get the fact.
You
didn't get my
fact. So if you
missed it? Oh, yes, I did. Yes,
okay.
I did.
That's what we're going for. So, Dr. Lewis, you can...
You want us to work down the topics?
Yes.
All right.
The equality with men and divorce as a wife.
Okay. We talk about equality with men. But I was trying to suggest in my rush through from Augustine to whatever, is that I do think the Christian tradition is ambivalent. I do think it understood from the very beginning two things. It's very interesting to read these guys because, in fact, they come out on the side of subordination. But they know better, and so because they've got Genesis to deal with. And there are two things about even Genesis 2. I mean, they know that humanity, male and female, is created in the image of God, period. And there's that egalitarian thread, and they can't quite get away with it. Now, when you get to the popular literature, they abandon it entirely, but that's another story. The other thing about it is the business of Adam's rib. You're right, actually. Church fathers dwelt on that discussion of woman from Adam's rib at a level beyond belief. But what they came out was that what the rib tells you, there's this wonderful passage, and I was trying to find it, and I can't remember which of the characters. So, John, you might be able to help me on this, or one, someone else. There's a wonderful passage in which someone is going on and on about why the rib, and the outcome of that is that so that woman is neither the head nor the foot but of man, but walks side by side. And it's a wonderful phrase. It does not settle the issue for the tradition. You're right. By and large, the tradition is subordinationist, and one of the real, from my point of view, from some issues that we share a concern about, one of the real negative aspects of that is that in the tradition, as issues of sexual and family violence become an issue, the justification for violence against women within the family is I was disciplining her for her insubordination. So that comes home to roost for us in some very negative ways down the tradition. So, but I do think the other thing, the other tradition stands, and then there's this discussion we had this morning about the principle and the behavior.
Thank you.
I just have one brief comment on the concept of equality. Because I'm sure some of you might say, in what sense did Islam equate men and women when the share of inheritance of women is in most cases, not all, by the way, in most cases is half that of men. I know that nobody raised it, but let me raise it also just to clarify and remove any doubt about it. See, I like to think in terms of equity rather than the word equality, because sometimes equality might convey a meaning of superficial equality in each and every item. For example, you could have a number of currencies in your pocket that adds up to the equivalent of 1,000 US dollars. I could have exactly the same value, but different currencies. In the matter of inheritance, you find that unlike the predominant system in the West today, for example, Islam has given women an additional, or additional, not just an additional, additional financial securities and rights that it did not give to men. For example, during engagement, she's on the receiving side. At the time of marriage, she receives the marital gift, which is, of course, often. There is no minimum or maximum, but normally it tends to be consistent with the person's financial status. If she has any property prior to marriage, it remains entirely hers, and she's not responsible to spend a penny, even in her, on her own food, clothing, housing, and all her needs. Fourthly, if she earns income after marriage, either from her previous property or from work with the mutual understanding with the husband, she is entitled to keep the entire additional income exclusively for her financial security. If she gets divorced, she is guaranteed full support during the waiting period, which could extend up to 9 months if she's pregnant. The child support is guaranteed. So in one way, you could say that there are so many items where Islamic Sharia has given women much more financial security, more rights than men. So when that is balanced to some degree in the shares of inheritance then I hope that we understand what you mean by the concept of equity, that it refers more to the equality, not in each and every simple item, but the totality of rights, privileges, and responsibilities that are quite balanced, if not even to say it's tilted even more towards financial security for the woman. I just wanted to just comment on what we mean by equality.
Thank you.
Can I comment on that?
Okay, go ahead, please.
Again, you know, I'm impressed. How could I not be? I think one of my concerns, and it's a concern out of my own tradition, is that many of those kinds of things that happen in the West, I don't begin to understand how that all came about for you. But when that comes about in the West, it has overtones of inability to survive. It has overtones of women being unable in the society to be full part of the society and therefore must be protected. I do things with women who ask their husband's permission to go someplace. And they will say to me, well, you know, it's not really permission. I mean, it's a custom. We just say, you know, may I go to such and such, may I go to such and such a thing. But he never has to ask it. And the woman always feels, and this is how inbred this is and how ingrained this is, the woman always feels that it's a sign of his care over her that he is giving her these permissions or that he takes care of her financially or all this other business that we're talking about. When we talk about equity, and I appreciate that, I like that word, it's very difficult to explain to men what we mean by equity because sexism and kind of the patriarchal model is so ingrained in all of our societies that you don't have a clue unless you have been a minority person. And if you have been a minority person in some relationship, then try to make the transference of learning. Try to apply to women the experience you have had as a minority. It's not so much that what's written down or handed over. It's the treatment. It's the understanding of full value. It's when people don't talk to you louder because they think you don't understand them.
Thank you.
I just have a brief comment on that, if I may. Yeah, I'm usually quick. I think there's a common notion that seems to be in the West, common in the West, that perhaps missed the point as seen by Muslims. From the people I talk to, they seem to be a sort of notion that if the wife is supported by the husband, that this is a sort of paternalism, that she has to be dependent upon him as if he is giving her charity by supporting her, and that only if she works and earns money, she would have her dignity. This is not the way at all that the Muslim looks at it, because as Sharia, which is coming from Allah, from divine source, has already made it an incumbent and duty on man to look after the financial support of the family. It becomes not a charity to the wife to support her, it becomes a sacred duty. It does not mean that the wife who's staying at home is idle, as again many Westerners might think. On the contrary, Islam views the role of male and female as complementary roles, not just competing roles for supremacy, because supremacy is only for Allah Himself. So the complementarity of these roles, if it requires, for example, that when the children are small and the mother needs them most and the father takes care of all the financial needs of the family, is not doing a charity, he's doing his duty and is enabling his wife to be as a female, to make the best of her femaleness also, being a good mother to the children. And finally, on the question of treatment, you put your finger on the right point also, because that's something that both in the Quran and the teaching of the Prophet has been very much emphasized. Just to quote a couple, when he said, the best of you is the best to his family, and I am the best of you to my family. He says, it is only the generous in character who is good to women, and it's only the wicked who insult them. مَا أَكْرَمَهُنَّ إِلَّا كَرِيمٌ وَلَا أَهَانَهُنَّ إِلَّا لَئِيمٌ So when we deal with one aspect, it's actually within the context also of other areas.
Since you started the treatment of women, and we have already an item that talks about the treatment of women as viewed by the scriptures, if you don't mind, let's pick up on that and save some time. So I'd like you to continue your discussion on the treatment, and then we'll move to that point and come back to the other point of divorce after we finish this part.
You want me to continue on the Krishna Kirtan?
Yes.
One very quick way of look at it in a very simple way is to look as to how women are to be treated as daughters, wives, mothers, and sisters in faith in general. As children or as daughters, the Prophet was very clear that one should not discriminate between his children. In one hadith, actually, he says, وَلَمْ يُؤْثِرْ وَلَدَهُ عَلَيْهِ. If one had two daughters, did not favor his son, specifically pointed on her, God will enter him into paradise. In one hadith, he said that if one has two daughters, he did not bury them alive like the ignorant pre-Islamic Arabs did some. He did not insult her and raise her kindly and properly, that he and I will come in paradise like this. And he pointed with his fingers. The Prophet showed that in his own behavior. Whenever Fatima, his daughter, came, he stood up, kissed her, and let her sit in his place. And she reciprocated the same. As a wife, suffice to refer to the Quran, Surah 30, in Ayah 22, of the signs of Allah, the signs of His mercy and wisdom, that He created you from your same type, same nature, min anfusikum, spouses, that you might find peace and tranquility in them. And He ordained between you love and compassion. Though herein are signs for those who reflect. And I quoted other hadiths also on how one should treat his wife. As a mother, even though this is a weak narration, but that's basically, that the meaning is correct, it says paradise is at the feet of mother. However, a much stronger and more authentic narration related to the Prophet is the famous story when a man came to him and he said, tell me, who among all people is most worthy of my kindness and good company? He said, your mother. He said, who's next? He said, your mother. Who's next? Your mother. Only in the fourth time, he said, your father. My preferable way of putting it is like 75% of the kindness to the mother, 25% to the father, or to put it in Olympic terms, gold medal first place for the mother, silver medal for the mother, bronze medal for the mother, and for the father maybe a consolation certificate. As a sister in faith, one, the Prophet used a very beautiful expression that has two shades of related meanings, إِنَّمَا النِّسَاءُ شَقَائِقُ الرِّجَالِ, that women are but, and the word شَقَائِق in Arabic could mean two things. The other half, that means they are the half of the society, or شَقَائِق also means sisters, but the sisters of men. The Quran speaks about men and women proceeding from one another. بَعْضُكُمْ مِنْ بَعْضٍ. You proceed one from the other. And this is just a short, very quick touch of many that are available.
Well, there are various tacks to pick on that. I think one of the important things to say is that very often in the New Testament, if you look at Jesus' treatment of women, it radically changes the challenges the kind of conventions of its day. And maybe one of the, I mean, and a lot of the stories of the Samaritan woman, of the woman who pours expensive oil and washes his feet, and a whole variety of stories are stories in which he treats women who would have been otherwise thought as outcasts, as strangers, as immoral, with care, with equality, and so forth. Perhaps the most important and interesting of these is that actually the witnesses to the resurrection are in the first place women. In a society where women were not allowed to be witnesses in a court of law. So there are many ways in which the New Testament challenges taken for granted assumptions about women's place. It probably is not a full story of the kind of thing we would talk about in a modern society of how we know justice for women when we recognize it. It's not entirely that kind of text. But it gives us some clues, I think, to, and it has given clues throughout the ages to people who don't always pay too much attention, that there is maybe another vision of the standing of women in this faith tradition. There is also a wonderful Old Testament text. I can't even pronounce his name. It's the daughters of Zelophehad, who come to Moses when their father dies and says, you know, we have no brothers. We should be able to inherit the land, because otherwise his name will have nowhere to go. It was in part a patriarchal assumption, but nonetheless it had to do with whether women could inherit land, and Moses kind of hems and haws, and finally Moses goes to God, and God says they should inherit the land. So there are both in the Hebrew scriptures and in the Christian New Testament glimpses, stories, ways for us to think differently about equality. And I agree with you that equality does not mean sameness. What we mean by it is a different thing. But I do think it's a text that gives us some reason to think that at least respect and care and love and a real honoring of women is a real part of the tradition. Not always practiced.
Thank you.
Didn't restructure society, I regret to say.
Hey, any more comments on the treatment before we move to the other point? On both sides. Okay, let me move to the next point, which is the divorce as a right. How do you view divorce in Christianity and Islam? Okay, you can start with the question.
My understanding is that at present, in many of the Protestant traditions, divorce is understood as acceptable. The Roman Catholic Church, of which I am a member, of course, you know, no divorce. And it arose probably with good intentions, again, caring for women, realizing that women were, if they were put aside by their husbands in primitive societies, then they were simply put aside by their husbands and needed to be cared for, and very often could not go back to their father's house. And so the legislation, so to speak, arose to protect women who at that time did not have any way to protect themselves. Roman Catholics are very, very, very difficult for us to change anything. So it probably within the next 300 or 400 years, you know, the dialogue will end. In practice, however, in practice, and in counseling sessions at this point, there is a recognition that people, that the coming together, and this is, stems from Scripture and stems from early tradition, that in the tradition, marriage is established for mutuality and for the procreation of children. We have been heavy on the procreation of children's side, but in fact, of late, in the last 20 years, we have talked seriously about the mutuality. And in light of that, there are many instances in which couples are counseled toward separation and divorce simply because they will not be able to realize their full potential. But in the legal sense, in the Roman Catholic Church, it is not acceptable. And I just want to say one other thing about that. It brings us to the idea of what the faith traditions mean to us. For us as Christians, the tradition is not once and for all institutionalized. I think what we see it as a prophetic mission, you know, and I think we try to see our traditions as prophetic missions in the world that take on a life and whatever. But it is not, there certainly are no bases in Scripture, either in the Jewish Scriptures or in the Christian Scriptures, for women being able to initiate some kind of separation, even though it is a difficult situation.
Thank you.
Just a quick remark on the method of divorce. Again, a matter of methodology first. That, and by the way, when we make this comparison, we should not be fair, should not be unfair to one faith or the other. And to say it humbly, but hopefully in good spirit also. You see, when one reads the New Testament, I don't think it is as comprehensive as the Quran. It's definitely in the Quran and the numerous tradition of the Prophet. There is much more detailed information about the structure of family law that is not parallel to the Bible. So one cannot really say, all right, but you don't have that. But, and that's why in the case of Islam, really, in the Quran itself, as well as the second primary source of Islam, in Hadith, you find enough information, really, to make a basic statement about the approach to divorce. Number one, that divorce is the least desirable thing. It is only like an inevitable evil. That's understandable. Secondly, that there are various forms of marriage dissolution, but unfortunately in the Western media sometimes some forms are never mentioned or heard of. One, marriage could be dissolved by mutual agreement between husband and wife, in which case he utters divorce. Two, divorce can be initiated by the unilateral utterment or utterance of the husband. That's legitimate. Three, divorce could be initiated by the utterance of the wife herself if during the marital contract that was included as one of the conditions known as the asma remaining in her hand. Fourthly, even if the husband refuses to divorce his wife and he's wronging her, like for example abusing her or mistreating her, she has the right to go to a family court judge, present her case, and there are numerous bases in Sharia, very liberal bases actually, to the point of even saying that if he has bad breath that is very difficult and she was not aware of that before marriage, you could still ask for that. Not to trivialize the question of divorce, but to open the door for reasonable grounds. And if the judge finds this falls within the legitimate reasons, he can grant divorce whether the husband likes it or not. But there is one final form also, not only unknown in Western media, but I must say in all honesty, sometimes in some conservative Muslim countries, the scholars themselves do not speak about it too much. And that's known as khulla, or divestiture, which means that even if the husband is at no fault, he's taking care of his wife, treating her properly, supporting her, he has done nothing wrong whatsoever. But for some reason or the other, private reason, the wife cannot stand living with him. Okay? And she doesn't want to go to court and put the dirty linen. She simply doesn't want to. In that case, she can ask for khulla. And khulla basically is the same like divorce, except that she would be willing, in that case, to return to him whatever marital gift he gave her. And that would prevent abuse, so that a woman does not get married to a man, get $10,000 marital gift, and they say, honey, I don't love you. You know, even though, of course, honey, I don't love you might not go together. But anyway, coming next day and divorce him, marry another one. So the idea is that if she's sincere about it and there's no fault on his part, then it would be unfair to deprive him from the marital gift that he paid with the understanding of continuation of marriage. So I hope that that clarified the picture, that divorce actually is mutual right. The procedure might vary slightly, but otherwise the right is there.
Do you have any comments, Dr. Ross?
I don't think so. I think Jean has talked to the fact that in different traditions this is different. I was actually sitting back here thinking about whether rights language is quite the language for this set of issues. Sort of the thing we back into also in the morning about homosexuality. It is, of course, the fact that in many Protestant traditions, it is at least, it's legitimate, it is within Christian faith to divorce in certain kinds of situations. And it has become a real issue currently in situations of abuse. In many Protestant traditions, it is still not considered appropriate to the faith. That is, they will, all those Bible citing, more conservative traditions will cite the biblical injunctions against divorce as a way of saying, no, it's not a right, or at least it's not a Christian
right. Okay, I have a suggestion for you, but we'd like to move to the point of the dress code. Dress code, so that you would like to talk about it.
No, I mean, I suggested that because Sister Aisha, we should address that since I talked before, I don't want to monopolize. So,
And ladies always have soft, nice voices, so get closer to the mic.
The issue of the dress code for the Muslim woman has been one that is continually raised in the West, and I do believe in most cases is distorted by media. I don't believe that it is generally the intent of the common people of America to be extremely judgmental of the way we dress. It is different, but I do believe it has been distorted. It tells us in the Quran, in Surah 24, Surah Al-Nur, and say to the believing women that they should lower their gaze and guard their modesty, that they should not display their beauty and ornaments except what must ordinarily appear thereof, that they should draw their veils over their bosoms and not display their beauty except to their husbands and fathers. And it goes on with the list of people to whom she can take the hijab off and be in the presence. I would like to point out, however, that in the ayat immediately in front of this one, Allah has also commanded that men, likewise, lower their gaze and guard their modesty and guard their purity. There is some controversy, even in Islam, between the scholars about the issue of what must ordinarily appear, but there are a number of hadith in one, and it is declared as weak, however there are others, but in one very popular one, when Asma appeared in the presence of the Prophet, peace be upon him, she was in some kind of a transparent, is the translation I got, or some kind of light clothing. And he pointed to her and said that nothing should be seen of her except this and this. And he pointed to his face and hands. This has been taken as one of the basic concepts that women should cover everything except the face and the hands that would normally appear if you were working or going out the door or whatever. Your hands normally are visible and your face, of course, is visible. In Surah 33, the Revelation says, tell thy wives and daughters and believing women that they should cast their outer garments over their persons when abroad, that they should be known and not molested. This again, the idea of wearing the jilbab or wearing a long robe or something when one goes out, throwing a cover over the body so that the body is not revealed to strangers, to men, and to other women on the street. This is just a point of modesty and chastity protection for the women. And I can testify to the fact that in this country, since I started to wear a hijab and put on a jilbab most of the time, I can walk past construction sites, and I don't get that, hey, baby, and all this whistle stuff and all these other comments. They back up. Many times they cross the street, and they go someplace else. So there is a distancing that is immediately apparent. They don't violate the personal space, even on buses and subways. It's very rare that you will be pushed, whether someone will even come and sit by you unless there's nothing else available. On the matter of covering the hair, the idea of the hijab, this also, I think, is quite clear from the Quran that says to cover the body except for what would appear, the face and the hands. And it tells us in Quran to obey Allah and obey the Prophet. Therefore, if this is sunnah, and I have been told by some Muslims that covering, wearing the scarf is really only tradition, it is not really a Quranic injunction, but the Quran does tell us to follow the example of the Prophet. Therefore, we wear the scarf. As far as it being any other symbol, no. And I mentioned that earlier. It is not a symbol of male authority, male dominance, or subservience. The North American Council of Muslim Women has a slogan that says, I have decided to cover my hair, not my mind. So it is not a symbol of any regression, backwardness, our entrance into a society that says that we should be subservient and weak.
Thank you. Just one quick comment. My wife was telling me something interesting that happened to her. A few years back, the Pope came to visit Halifax. In preparation for that, the Catholic Church gathered, you know, all kinds of various orders of sisters and nuns and so on. And my wife happened to be passing by. So someone looked at her and he noticed that she's covering like those sisters. And he said to her, sister, which order do you belong to? She said, none. But the point that really I'd like to make here is that it has been quite familiar for a lot of people to see Christian sister, Catholic sisters and others in their dress. They did not see that as ridiculous or in position of any man. They thought that this is part of their personal religious commitment. Yet the strange thing about this biases and double standards sometimes, that some people would look at a Muslim woman like that with ridicule. Again, thinking automatically because of the media that she's doing that because some male imposed that on her or because it relates to symbol of authority or whatnot, not as a religious individual commitment on the part of the woman herself.
Thank you. Please.
Well, as somebody that was in a habit for 25 years, I can understand your concern. I don't think that I have ever heard of it, heard of the dress of the Muslim women as indicating anything other than a reverence for your beauties. And just as an aside, I was in a habit. I am a Dominican, and we wore these long white habits, and was in it for 20 years or so. And we made the choice to move out of them because they did isolate us from the public with whom we worked. People did look at us as different and kind of in a special way that was not conducive to our ministry. So we moved out of them. But I have great reverence for religious dress and for people's choice to wear what they want to, and I believe that women should be able to wear what they want to, and I understand that that's, your choice to wear it, and I say go for it. Basically, everybody is in some... If we look around every day, we see all these men in suits. I mean,
The question is there a dress code in Christianity or not?
The question, there is not a dress code in Christianity, and there is also not in... what there is in Christianity is somehow a linking with the covering of a woman's body and her level of modesty, which is very questionable and needs to be addressed.
Thank you. Dr. Ruth?
Well, maybe... I don't know where you were going with that, Jean, but
neither
I could
I.
pick that up. Certainly there are traditions about modesty in the history of the Christian tradition, and especially the modesty of women. I don't know that we addressed the habit of suits of men, but I want to say something about... I think that's a strength, and I think there's a sense in which, particularly in a contemporary society where there is so much, in some ways, freedom, that is, women can be about in public in a way that they may not be able to be other places, that there may be some protection on that. I think we should be wary of our assumptions about this. From what we know about rape, the dynamics in that are power and control. They are not sensuousness. And in that sense, modesty is not a protection. This is not an argument against modesty. I'm more inclined toward it than less inclined toward it. I just think that there are some assumptions about the dynamics of violence and abuse that are not, in fact, borne out by some of the language about modesty will protect us. It's often said to women who are violated on the streets or harassed at work, if you would just dress more modestly or wear a long skirt or something, this wouldn't have happened to you. What we know about abuse is that that's not true. And so I want to affirm the dress code, but I want to flag what I think is a possible misinterpretation of how much it protects us.
Thank you. I think we'll move to the other point. If you have any other comments, we'll delay to the second part of the discussion participation. So keep on going to visit sometime in the next 40 minutes. Right now, we would like to talk about philosophy and the Bible and the Quran.
Which discussion do you want to start with?
Well, we started meeting last time, so we'll just go to... either Sister Jean or Dr. Rose.
Which
can I want to say? Number five here.
Polygamy?
Yes.
I mean, polygamy, again, this is another one of those things where everything is not written. There are Christian traditions. There are Catholic parishes in Africa and in Asia where polygamy is the rule of the day, simply because that is the cultural milieu in which the people live, and it is the survival mode for the tribe or the community. So, however, here in the United States, polygamy is not recognized as legitimate for Christians or other people. But again, I have to emphasize that it has more to do with the cultural milieu and the way the community and the society is organized than with specific religious teaching.
Thank you.
Five basic points. One is the question, did Islam invent polygamy? Because again, and by the way, the correct word is polygyny, not polygamy, just for correction. Mm-hmm. Anyway, the answer to that is obviously no, and I refer you to work of one of the most prominent sociologists, anthropologists, that's Edward Westermarck, in his two-volume work, History of Human Marriage, in which he describes how polygyny was practiced in many nations and religions, including among Jews and Christians. That's a long story, but he documents all that. That's no problem. So that's the point that I'd like to emphasize, even though it sounds simple, but it's not simplistic, because typically in the West, polygamy or polygyny and Islam is one and the same. And the moment somebody asks you, what's your name, Muhammad, your religion, Islam, third question, how many wives do you have? This seems to be the pattern of thinking. Another point that needs to be dispelled also, that polygamy is something that really goes with Islam. And I must clarify that in terms of the commands of Sharia, it is not an order. It is not a command on the Muslim. There is no indication even, any conclusive text that shows that it is even desirable. Its classification in the scale of 5 points in Islamic law, what you should do, should not do, is the mubah, permissible. Thirdly, the same Quran, there's only one ayah actually that deals with this. In the same surah where this occurred, it says that if you fear that you will not be just and fair between your wives, then marry only one. And then later on it says you will never be totally, you know, fair if you have more than one wife. Which means actually, even though it does not prohibit it outright, it seems to indicate that in Islam, like in many other religions, monogamy actually is the rule, polygamy is the exception. And if we were to say that the basic rule in Islam is four wives, which is the maximum per man, you're talking about a demographic structure where you have 80% females and 20% males, and this is unheard of. My fourth point is that the proper interpretation also of the Quran is to look into the occasions of revelation, which might give some insight into the meaning. And this verse in the Quran that dealt with marriage of up to four actually was revealed after the battle of Uhud, in which scores of Muslims, dozens of Muslims were martyred, leaving behind their wives, the widows, and their children, the orphan children who needed some help and support. So that perhaps might shed some light. And the Prophet himself took the lead in marrying some of the women who were just about his age or older, people in the 50s like Umm Salama, with five orphan children. And that was quite clearly a humanitarian gesture to teach others that you should take care of them, because a widow is not just waiting for some handout or somebody to give her food. She needs the warmth of a home. Children need a father figure also for their upbringing. And finally, why didn't Islam prohibit it? Of course, there is definitely, and I agree with Sister Jane on this, sometimes we get too ethnocentric, and we think that something that might not suit our culture here in America should be applicable anywhere in the world, under all cultures, all circumstances, at all times. And this is, from the anthropological standpoint, quite nonsensical, really. Obviously, there are needs, there are places where polygamy might serve a function. And even today, in the 20th century, and give one example of Afghanistan, 1.5 million people were martyred or killed during the Russian invasion. Some women and children, yes, many, but the great majority are men. What to do with this great imbalance in a small nation between the number of men and women? What to do with the widows? What to do with young girls also are reaching the age of puberty and are looking for marriage? And what to do with the orphans? Obviously, in that case, a Muslim should not approach it by way of apology or anything. Actually, it's positive. It is a much more humane and moral solution to many problems in different places and different times.
Thank you, Dr. Jibba. Do you have any comments? They took more time, so
yeah.
You still have some credit if you want to.
I think.
Okay.
That decision is very helpful.
Okay. Then let's talk about the last point on this part, which is, can a woman be a feminist and religious at the same time? Maybe for the benefit of the audience, we define first, Sister Aisha, define first what you mean by a feminist and then go into the question.
As a point of personal preference, my opinions and references to this, I'm most directing to the Muslim members of this audience, more than to the sisters, who I already know basically we have an agreement about this. Feminism, the term a feminist, let's define it first. It denotes a concept of equality for women, whether in their home, the workplace, or on the street while going grocery shopping. This is not a radical viewpoint. This is simple equity and equality. To me, in Islam, one can be a feminist and a religious, spiritual person at one and the same time. There is no violence of conflict. If we look in the early days of Islam, we have thousands of women, literally at least 2,500 women at a conservative estimate, who transmitted the deen of Islam and who taught, were extremely brilliant, were noted as legal scholars, jurists, and poets. Umm Salama, who often stood up to the very opinionated Omar, repeatedly is a prime example of such a woman. Aisha literally fought with the Caliph, Ali, when she felt that he was wrong. She debated legal points, one of the greatest transmitters of hadith in the early days of Islam. The lady named Yaqub once stood up when she heard a legal point explained by Abdullah ibn Mas'ud and told him, "I have read the entire Quran and have not found your explanation anywhere in it." And she didn't back down from her opinion. We have the teacher, Sayyidina Nafisa, the granddaughter of Hassan, who taught Imam al-Shafi. Even Omar, who was never noted as a champion of women's rights, appointed Shafa bin Abdullah as the inspector of the market in Medina. If he had had any concerns that it was not permitted for women to be working outside the home, or especially in marketplace of all places where she would be in constant daily contact with men, and I'm sure Omar would never have appointed her to such a position. Muhammad al-Ghazali, the modern scholar of Islam, has called this exclusion of women in Islam, and I quote from his article, "The Rise of Bedouin Fiqh." This is not Islamic. While I'm not going to sit here and argue about Bedouin, I do support his general statement that for women who transmitted and taught one fourth of the deen of Islam, it is a pathetic shame that women are not accepted as scholars today. You rarely see Islamic women giving conferences and teaching in economics and in other fields where they have every right to be prominent. I believe our confusion about this lies in terms of equality of rights and equal identity. In the West, we do have some confusion with this. I personally went through this problem. We are not identical to men, nor do most feminists that I've ever met want to be a man. However, we have confused the identity with equality in the West because of the nature of the fight. If men set the criteria, and they set it as economic independence, aggressiveness, the ability to climb that corporate ladder no matter what, then that criteria is set for us women, and that's what we have to do to get ahead. This, in many cases, violates the nature of women, which I do believe is different from men. We do tend to be generally more interpersonally skilled, more collaborative. We like more participation with others than men do. But in many cases, in this country in particular, we've had to violate some of that nature in order to advance. If you're in a power struggle, and this is a power struggle in the West, then you have to fight with whatever criteria the people in charge have given you. This is not true in Islam. And I do believe we have a very fine example of how to be a good woman and a good feminist at the same time.
Thank you. Please.
Well, I do believe that one can be a feminist and a Christian at the same time. And I believe that on grounds that Christian faith itself, in its affirmation of the creation of women and men in God's image, in its long tradition of discussing the covenant and the whole notion of mutual responsibility for one another, not necessarily specifically gender defined, in the understanding of shalom, salam, which is peace, in a whole variety of ways. When I talk about feminism, what I mean by feminism is participation in the struggle for justice, really care and justice for women and between women and men. And I think there are grounds in the Christian faith for participation in that struggle. As with everything else, feminists themselves argue about how we know feminism when we see it, or how we know justice and care for women and between women and men when we see it, and some of the issues around equality, whether it means sameness, whether it means something else. These are all matters still under discussion, so I don't think we've got the matter settled, and we certainly don't have the struggle won. But I do believe that, at least certainly for me, the feminism that I try to articulate is really deeply rooted in my faith and my understandings of God's call and God's creation of what it means to be human in the presence of God.
Thank you. Sister Jean, since you didn't have a chance to be consulted on what's on this piece of paper in front of you, would you like to add any point?
Well, I like the last one a lot. Can a woman be a feminist and a religious? I very strongly believe that a religious woman must be a feminist, as well as must be anti-racist, anti-colonial, and anti-militaristic. What I believe about God is that God transcends all of human life. And knowing God is something that will be a process of a lifetime, and that human communities must develop in their understandings and their relationships in order to know more about God. And the only way that happens is to break down barriers of power and control. I do not believe that real feminists are in competition with men. I think that what we are attempting to do is even out the playing field. And I think that if one believes that it is God's will that we become whatever in the end, then one has to commit to those kinds of struggles. So it's not a question of can one. To me, it's a question of how does one do it and do it faithfully.
Thank you. We'll move to the next part of the program, which is the discussion, participation in the program. And may I invite Dr. John Polakowski and Dr. Yvan Haddad to come over here. Imam Shakir. And we're supposed to have Sister Nancy Ali, but I assume she's not here. So Dr. Morsi, is he around?
I'm so grateful.
Somebody call from Dr. Morsi. He won't ask.
Look. Can you sit over there and divide the house?
No, sit over here. Sit over here.
Yeah.
Can
you sit over there?
Sure.
If you want to shift to our side, you're welcome.
Yeah. Well, the thing is, I don't like
hi,
it.
Hi, physically.
I don't like
it. Come in.
Yeah.
That's fine.
Great.
All right. And we'll welcome the gentleman right here.
Good exchange.
Maybe you should have said the paper change. I think it's a good idea.
She feels comfortable. Do you feel comfortable there?
Why not?
Good. Okay, let me introduce Dr. Yvan Haddad. Just moved to this side. Dr. Yvan Haddad is professor of Islamic history at the University of Massachusetts, acted as the president of the Middle East Studies Association from 1985 to 1990, and president of New England region of American Academy of Religion from 1985 to 1990. She is the author of several books on Islam, among which are the Islamic Values in the United States, Woman, Religion, and Social Change, and six. There are also a couple of other books that are not mentioned over here, also Islam in America. I'm sure you will find her books very informative and very educational. She's also the editor, she was the editor of the Muslim World Quarterly from 1980 to 1988. Dr. John Polakowski, who just came over here, is a servant priest, professor of social ethics at Catholic Theological Union, author of 10 books, including Catechetics and
Prejudice, Sinai and Calvary, and other books. He is the senior editor of Theological Review and member of the editorial board of Exploration and a few other journals. He had frequent appearances on radio and television in the United States, including ABC, CBS, and NBC, as well as many other countries. We have Dr. Hussein Mosi, who just came in right now. He's the co-founder of the Christian-Muslim Dialogue and Research Committee, which is different than CORD, the Committee of the Religious Dialogue. This one is located in Chicago over here. Participated in many Christian-Muslim dialogues, including the first two dialogues that we did. And Imam Shakir Sayyid is the director of the Islamic Teaching Center of the Islamic Society of North America, ISNA, and he's the director of the Board of Education of ISNA also. He participated in many dialogues before, and he's a well-known speaker and credited speaker within the Muslim community in the United States over here. I hope everyone has that piece of paper that says that your role is to make comments and enhance the discussion that took place. So I would like to start with any of you who's ready to give his input or her input. Okay.
Should we go ahead, Tyson?
Yeah, go ahead.
This is a question to both sides of the aisle, as they say.
Yeah, get closer to the mic, please.
Okay. We've heard so much about the freedom of women, equality of women, so on and so forth on both sides. The question to the Muslim side, isn't it a sort of slavery to ask the women to obey their husbands to get to paradise? If that is the door through which they have to go, isn't this a form of slavery? On the other side, if it is true, as the Bible mentions it, that the brother of the deceased takes the right to marry the widow, isn't this also a form of making women like a commodity to be inherited?
No, there is absolutely no slavery, if understood in the proper Islamic and Quranic terminology, rather than the terminology that are commonly circulated among people. The question of obedience in Islam is not a matter of dictatorship or capriciousness, because the Prophet himself has already qualified what that obedience means. And first of all, he said, لا طاعة لمخلوق في معصية الخالق, that there is no obedience due to any human being if he tells you to do something contrary to what God ordained, which means that there is independent personality, even if you are not the boss, quote unquote, if you're not the leader or head of a family or group or company, nobody can tell you to do something contrary to what Allah. So there is limitation of what obedience means. It's not capricious command. Number two, and this is also mentioned in the Quran, وَلَا يَعْصِينَكَ فِي مَعْرُوفٍ, describe good women who came to make the allegiance to the Prophet, and they say one of their commitment that they will not disobey you in ma'ruf, which means something, request which is reasonable and fair. And the Prophet himself emphasized that innama ta'atu fil ma'ruf, obedience is only in something reasonable. Once you redefine, because you see in the Western psyche today, when you use the word obedience, obey, it sounds more like, you know, a military commander dictating. But in the Quranic terminology, it doesn't have that connotation at all. With this limitation, with this kind of definition, it becomes nothing more than the normal type of leadership that is expected in any society. Even if you have a community of men, you have a company, economic organization, social organization, they have to be someone who is responsible. And if somebody is responsible, obviously there is some reasonable obedience with discussion. And the Quran even does not speak about obedience without talking also about consultation. In fact, in the Quran, when it addresses, even in the hard situation, the sad situation of divorce, when there is an argument between husband and wife about weaning the child, it says, فَإِنْ أَرَادَ فِصَالًا عَنْ تَرَاضٍ مِّنْهُمَا وَتَشَاوِرٍ, If they decide by mutual consultation that the child should be weaned, there is no blame on them. And here is the case of hard feeling during divorce. How about the normal, regular marital relationship? So once you put it in that context, it has a totally different connotation.
Thank you. Is any of you, including Dr. John?
Let me start. When I listened to that biblical injunction, I guess that is one of the places where I'm inclined, as we did when we talked about polygamy or polygyny, to talk about historical context. In a community and in a time when women really could not be single.
Self-sufficient.
And self-sufficient. You might say it was a provision made. I think we don't know whether, and it's possible to think of contexts of this sort, which would have been involved mutual consent. But I think we may need mainly to look at that text in a context where a woman had to be in a family context. And this was one of many provisions. I think a lot of the polygamy discussion, and indeed even the place where it's taking place in Africa today, is really in the context of the Christian missionaries, which refused, if a man was married, polygamous, and became a Christian, he had to abandon all his wives, or all but one of his wives, who then just sort of wandered desolate in the cities, ending up in prostitution and violated in a variety of ways. Well, I think this was a context in which this made provision for the care and safety. I think that perhaps the situation has changed in this day, and we would not be bound by it in the same way.
Okay. You still have the follow-up, so go ahead.
Huh?
Go ahead.
The follow-up. As far as marrying the brother of the deceased, you offered some explanation. How about condemning the woman if she remarries as committing adultery?
I don't do that.
I'm saying
does the tradition condemn a woman who remarries?
Yes.
Many Christian traditions do not condemn a woman who remarries.
Okay.
I think some do.
I think an increasing number of the mainline traditions, even my own that doesn't formally approve divorce from a theological point of view, will no longer condemn a person in the same way. It's true that even 20 years ago, a person was viewed pretty much as an outcast, but would no longer condemn the person. In fact, in a way, it's not even accurate to say that there's no divorce in Catholicism. What there really isn't is remarriage. Because what you do have, and even that is not totally accurate, and I'll say that for my... First of all, many times, as I think you said, sister, people are advised to separate and seek a civil divorce because it's considered that their marriage just is not going to work. What they're not allowed to do in that case is remarry. However, there has been an increasing use of something called the annulment process in Catholicism, which many people don't like, many couples don't like, because it seems to imply that they never had a real marriage or a relationship in the first place. But in that case, they are certainly free to remarry if they get a church annulment, which also involves a civil divorce, because most nations don't recognize annulments in the same way. So you go through a process.
Okay, please, Dr. Hussein, I'd like you to talk on the mic, please.
I watched something one night in Quincy about the law. There was a lady in Wisconsin after she remarried for 20 years and had 6 kids. She went to the church and got the marriage annulled.
That's right.
So that declared that her children to be better. I mean, what is the religious system of that?
There isn't. It's a technical thing, No, there isn't, and that's why it's not the best way to confront this. It's getting around the law. It's getting around the law. But in actual fact, a lot of people have used it, so I just point this out. In fact, there was a very popular book that was selling not in religious bookstores, but in most of the so-called secular bookstores, by a lay person who's a canon lawyer, on how to get the title of it was how to get an annulment, and it was a big seller. They were featuring some of the secular bookstores.
Thank you. Remember that we have to raise as much points as we can. We don't want to get fast into one point and spend all the time on that point. I'd like to have real input from, you know, we have about 40 minutes. Don't consume all of it in one point, please.
I have a question which I'd like to. I have both a concern and a question. And I guess it's mostly directed to the Islamic side, Muslim side. One of my concerns in this whole direction is we've been talking about very specific situations in which the Islamic tradition, some of which I didn't know, I think has a very excellent view of the situation of women. However, when I look generally at Muslim societies, I'm hard-pressed to find one that I, as a social ethicist, don't see a clear pattern of male political power dominant in practically every phase, in all phases of life. Now, I think you began to allude to that a bit in talking. Now, it's true, I think we have to make the distinction that we were pressing this morning. However, I think we can also go too far in pressing it. I mean, the reality is that, in a way, Islam or Christianity don't simply exist as ideal types. They exist as embodied in groups and in people living in nations. And as I look in the Islamic nations, now, we certainly have had Islamic countries, Pakistan, where a woman has been the head of state. So it's certainly not impossible to have a woman achieve the highest level of political authority. But by and large, I guess I would not feel comfortable with this discussion. When women were just assumed to have the right to full university education, to do the kinds of things that you were suggesting, to be full participants in cultural life, not to have to ask permission of anyone to do this. The protest over driving, I mean, in Saudi Arabia, I see it as such a minor thing. It may not be so minor to the women in Saudi Arabia, but that's in a way only the tip of the iceberg. It is the total, who controls the society? You were beginning to get to this question, I think. That, I think, is a question that has not been addressed. Now, the other question I have, and I'd like to hear the response on it, it sounded to me like there was some advocacy of a saying, well, that women are different, Islam protects that, and women should not get caught up in some of the power struggles of the Western world. Granted, there's a lot about Western society that disturbs me greatly, disturbs many of us. But the question is, are you thereby advocating that in the new Muslim effort to become part of the mainstream, which I see happening in North America, in Western Europe, you are saying that you do not feel that women, for example, Islamic women, Muslim women, should now assume major roles of responsibility in business, in government, in other areas of Western society? And that the Muslim societies are one question, but I'm also asking the question of Western societies, because you almost seem to me to be advocating that because of a certain difference, that Muslim women should not seek this role in Western societies, and I would have some problems with that.
Thank you.
Can I answer that?
Yes.
I don't believe that anything I said women should not be involved in the power struggle. We need to be involved. It's obligatory upon a Muslim woman to be involved when there is wrong being committed. That hadith that was read this morning is applicable to the believers, of which I'm one. However, what I am saying is very difficult for us to deal with, it's difficult for Western women also, is the fact that in getting into this struggle, which is severely difficult. It is a power struggle against a patriarchy, as well as a very dominant male society, is the fact that Islam commands us. We may go out and work. We are encouraged to contribute to the ummah. We have an obligation to contribute, particularly women like me whose children are grown. We have an obligation to get out there and to struggle. But we cannot throw off Islam in order to go into that struggle. The struggle has to change, has to adapt to Islamic principle, to the fact that I am equal, I have every right to go and work. If I want to be an engineer and go to work and I have a full office staff of men to deal with, then inshallah I will deal with them. But I will deal with them as a Muslim woman. And to demand of a Muslim that we change either our dress, or that I can't have a job because my head is covered, or I can't have a job because I wear a longer dress, that is something that the West is going to have to adjust to as we come into the struggle. So far, we are being pushed aside on many issues of dress. I'm a certified paralegal, but I can't work in a law office because I don't take this off. These are things that will have to be changed in order for the Muslims to fully participate. If the West is going to demand that we become less Muslim or less Islamic, then no. We will not participate in that sense. If that's what mainstreaming is, becoming like everybody else, then no. Then we have to draw a line. If, however, it means that we participate fully in correcting the wrongs in the society, then we are not only supposed to do it, we are obligated to do it.
Thank you. Yeah, a couple of more points on this. Well, of course, as John said, the theological foundation of Muslim women participating in all affairs of society is well established. There have been a slight difference of opinion in interpreting one particular hadith about being head of the state. I don't want to get into that detail, but it's not really a matter of belief or, you know, there are various ways of interpretations of this. But I think what you were concerned about is how does that relate historically or in the present time? I can give you three examples that relate to the methodology that I mentioned in my earlier presentation this morning. The distinction, again, between a clear text in the Quran that you say, the Quran says women shouldn't drive a car, for example. If you have such a text, nobody can argue with you. It's so clear. But this is not the case. You find many other interpretations has been subjected to the mood and the circumstances and the conviction and cultural norms, not Islamic norms necessarily, of the interpreter. I'll give you an example. The argument I heard about some of the jurists in Saudi Arabia, and by the way, this is the only country in the Muslim world that I've known that says restricts women from driving, that they say that this to protect women, that there have been lots of people coming from other countries to work there, and there have been cases of molestation, and the best way is to make sure that woman is accompanied in the car, so that's for her protection. But this is not the Quran or Sunnah. This is an interpretation which is, to me, an erroneous interpretation. It is erroneous, number one, because the Prophet himself, when praising the women of Quraysh, he says, خَيْرُ نِسَاءٍ رَكِبْنَ الْإِبْنِ, among the descriptions that they are the best women who rode camels. Their camels represented the Toyota and the Mercedes and the Buicks of today. That's their transportation. So why don't we look at it in that respect, in terms of analogy? Secondly, even if there is some argument for protection against possible danger or molestation, why restrict women from driving in the city like Riyadh, where it's all full with people going and coming? So I find that, again, a jurist can say that, but I find that a sort of thing that is not really ingrained on a clear text. A second example, can a Muslim woman become a judge? And you find lots of arguments historically among various Muslim scholars, jurists, can a woman be a judge or not? There is no text in the Quran or hadith of the Prophet directly saying this. So it becomes a matter of interpretation. That's why you find some scholars raised in a given closed community, more conservative community. They said, no, a woman cannot be a judge. And they give you all kinds of rationale similar to the rationale of not driving. Yet you find an Imam Abu Hanifa raised in Iraq, which is a more cosmopolitan community, is of the opinion by saying that if the witness of a woman is accepted in certain areas of the law, then why not her being a judge? Because there are similarities between being a judge and being a witness. Then you find an Imam al-Tabari looking at it in a more open way, the famous professor of the Quran, interpreter of the Quran. He says no. He says there is no text whatsoever, neither in the two primary sources of the Quran, of Islam, Quran and Hadith, that restrict that. He says there is no grounds, and in his opinion, that a woman could be a judge in any aspect of the law. So these are just a few. Another example is the question of witness, only in financial contract, because some people went too far, again, whether you really need more women than men and all of that. You find, again, that many jurists would tell you that the ultimate thing in the matter of witness is to establish justice. In our situation today, where a woman might have an MBA degree from Harvard University and knows about financial dealing than many men sweepers, how could we say that the judge could still reject her in a dogmatic basis and say, no, there should be more witnesses of women than men, because the purpose is to establish justice itself. And finally, 2 points. When we compare also historically, we have to be careful as to what point of time are we comparing and what part of the world are we comparing with. Unfortunately, Muslims are at a great disadvantage now, because you're comparing a particular level of progress in the West, Christian West, quote-unquote, if that term is correct, which I doubt anyway, vis-a-vis the decline, the period of being in the lower end in point of history. But if you go back, compare it differently, at the time of the Prophet and his immediate companions, we find that women were involved in everything, including the battlefield, including fighting even, when they chose to defend the Prophet and defend their faith. That is the ideal, then that's the point of reference and of comparison. And finally, sometimes also, given the tradition in the Western society, even though, of course, I'm not saying that or implying that that's what you believe, but a lot of people, I'm talking about the public, somehow equate Islam with Arabs in the Middle East, not knowing that the Arabs, all the Arabs together, Muslims and Christians, are a small minority compared with the 1 billion Muslims, that the largest Muslim country is non-Arab, Indonesia, that there are in India a Muslim minority that is twice as large as the largest Muslim country in the Arab world, which is Egypt, 60 million versus 120 in India, for example. But the point here is that Islam is not, or Muslim world, is not a monolithic thing. You could find, yes, in a place like Saudi Arabia, where a woman cannot even drive. Yet, you go to Egypt, for example, next door, and you find that women are serving in the highest possible position in the states. Some are in assembly, the representative assembly. You go to Indonesia, you find that the role and engagement of women is different. In Nigeria, it is not the same like other places. So I think, again, which area are we comparing? There's a great deal of diversity, but the criterion, really, how far or close are they to the ideal?
Before I move to Dr. Ivan, do you have a comment on what was said, Dr. Barkowski?
Well, the comment would only be that it's true about Egypt and a couple other places, but I see a challenge to that. And if I could say this respectfully, I mean, it seems to me that most of the women who have served in those positions that I have somehow been in contact with certainly do not, number one, adopt the Islamic dress code. Now, are they going to be, my question is there a new effort in Islam that will eventually root out these people who have made it? I get some sense from some of the Islamic women in countries like Egypt who have been part of the structure that indeed they're threatened, their position is threatened by some of the new Muslim, you know.
Well, first of all, you might have certain experiences. I do have experiences also of Muslim women in Egypt and other places who are highly committed and highly qualified and very active, like Dr. Abdeen, for example, who has established a charitable hospital, and she's a well-known physician and doctor, and she's very committed also to her faith. There are many articulate. The other thing about the dress code, I think it would be a mistake in my view to totally evaluate the commitment of the Muslim woman only in terms of the dress code. There is no question, if you look at it from the other side, that a Muslim woman who practices her faith was deeply committed, and in addition to that, she carried that also in terms of even her dress code. Obviously, she shows relatively more commitment. But it doesn't mean that others are to be weeded out or not to be considered committed. In my own experience traveling across the world in many places, I have met many Muslim sisters in one convention who are not in Islamic code. I come 2 years later, like Australia. I find them, they are and just for it. It means that the faith was there in their heart. The commitment was there, but maybe the pressures of the way they were raised, the society and where they were living. So I would not evaluate a Muslim woman entirely on one issue like dress.
Thank you. You forgive me. Okay, we'll move from Dr. Ivan to Dr. Musi. You can move to another point, by the way.
Well, basically,
and I'd like you to move to another
point. About the fact that we seem to be setting ourselves up as Christians versus Muslims, and we're sitting there, so we have to defend. Nobody's accusing. I'm not accusing anybody of anything, but it seems to me that there are some issues facing women, both Christian and Muslim, both here and overseas. And if we could talk about some way in which together we can work together to help with these problems, rather than sit here and defend. I mean, I'm not qualified to sit here and defend the faith according to the Baptists or some other very conservative Christian. What you have here is a group of very liberal Christians. And all of us sort of have a theology which is very open and accepting, and I don't want to be cast into a position where I have to sit and defend anything. And I find this sort of going on like a ping pong game, and I'm very uncomfortable with it. And I was wondering whether we can do something more positive,
sure,
rather than sit here and
please
try and defend. I don't know. What
were
you
going to
talk about?
Could we name some common issues?
What?
Ivan, could we name some common issues?
Well, come on. Why don't you come up with some issues that we are common issues rather than sort of... Yes.
I think part of the problem, and I know that for a fact, for us Muslims, that we are the one that always subject the media and the stereotype. Whenever you hear about Muslims in the media or Muslim women, I can produce for you volumes upon volumes from newspapers that speak about women in the veil and how they are suppressed and how they are subjected and how they are abused and how they are taken in slavery. And so part of that probably the sensitivity, I would say, on my part as a Muslim, I don't speak for other Muslims, is the fact that what I see blasted in the media all the time about Islam and the deliberate, what I consider it, as an intentional or unintentional, I don't know which one, campaign to smear the Muslims all the time politically, theologically, and socially. So do not be surprised that the Muslims are kind of like trying not only to explain their point of view, but also explain the inadequacies in the Christian faith also in regard to these issues.
Yeah, well, I thoroughly understand what you're saying. I mean, I agree with you. I go around always talking about the demonization of Islam, the kind of press that Islam has been having. On the other hand, you know, I can quote you books and magazine articles which also talk about Christian women, about Christianity and the West in just as derogatory. The thing is that I think we have to get off this name-calling. Yeah, I mean, I've had access to a lot of literature which talks about Christianity, this horrible religion. I don't identify with any of the women that are depicted there as Christian women. I don't. I mean, I have no idea what they're talking about. I'm not a slut. I don't sleep with every man I find. And yet, all this literature talk about Christian women as being these loose women, and this is what Christianity has done, and the West is a corrupt society. And it seems to me that if we stand here and sort of defend these accusations, you're preaching to the converted. Look around. You know, is there some way we can move beyond, you know, you are like this, I am like that, so we are better, you are good. This is all I'm saying.
May I throw a common ground that we definitely share that may bring some different discussion? Let us agree to the reality that neither the West, nor the East, nor the Middle East is based on Islam or Christianity. It is all based on secularism.
Absolutely.
So I take no offense.
That helps a lot.
I take no offense if somebody says women in Egypt or anywhere else do this or don't do that. It doesn't really matter to me. But still, I believe that the format of discussion here was to clarify what the basic tenets and teachings of each religion say about women, about human rights, about the dealing of minorities. And I believe
that from time to time you cannot escape the reality that you must live through as soon as you leave this hall. So people are between telling what they have learned from the book and talking about what they have to deal with in the street. We are caught in between. We are part and parcel of what is going on around us. So I believe that it should not take us long to identify with each other on what is common and what is different, but yet we should not be feeling any kind of like bad feeling, let me say, if we discuss the realities as they are and try to judge those realities according to the teachings of Islam, Christianity, or any religion for that matter. I believe that the purpose of religious awareness is to bring God into not only the classroom, but every room that man goes to get in. So what I'm saying is, let us not say reality is irrelevant, and let us talk about books, and let us not say books are irrelevant, let us accept reality. We have to address both with a reasonable way.
With your permission.
As long as we don't say Christian side, yeah. Muslim side. That's the part that you can get.
I think,
I think we are in it together, and let's not put each other against each other.
I think we have only 7 minutes left, so let us not talk about the philosophy of the dialogue itself. I think your point is well understood. Let us get into the points themselves and discuss one of them in the light of what you
said. Should I ask a question?
Why don't I
let them answer
Dr.
first?
Lewis, okay. Talk first. Okay, go ahead.
To what question? I was really going to propose that we take it, since Aisha and I have talked a lot about abuse. Figure out which one of these. About abuse, perhaps abuse against women, as an issue that we're both concerned about. And one of the things that I think we could do is taking that issue, ask what resources in both faiths do we have to stand against it. It's not, and I do think we have we also have practices which haven't been very good about standing against it. And that may be true in both, and I don't know that. My guess is we do have resources of both faiths to stand against abuse. And that maybe, is that the kind of thing you're talking about, Ivan? That we could then talk about what would be a shared...
Whether you say, we say. No, we're not like this. No,
yeah,
not like
that what we have is a shared commitment to stand against injustice of this ilk. That would have tremendous potential, I think, probably in cultures around the world, which, if not shaped by us, are at least informed by us in some ways. Could we do that? Is that the kind of thing you're talking about?
This was me. If you were willing, I would love that. Just, you know.
It's my whole life, even.
Yes. I don't mean to change the agenda for me. I'm just, okay.
Well, this part of the agenda is... We left that part of the agenda open so that you direct it the way you feel best for all the people here. So that was well intended to leave it open.
Can I read that
for you? May I just listen to Sister Aisha? She was going to say something and then we'll move to.
I wanted to comment on something Sister Jean brought up, which I think is an important point. She said for the women that we have to be not only pro-women, but anti-racist, anti-colonialist, etc. And I believe this is a major point that we can all come together. And what the gentleman was saying earlier about many Muslim women in positions of authority or whatever in the Middle East do not cover and don't wear the full Islamic dress, I think a lot of this is related to colonialism and to the idea of the equation that Islam is backward, has restricted the progress and technological status of the Middle East. It has taken the blame for that, as many traditional faiths do when it comes to progress and technology. So therefore, there has been an idea, you know, that to throw off all of the Islamic dress is to be, quote, more progressive. Eventually, for many women, inshallah, this changes. It took me years to cover my head. I did not do it. It was uncomfortable. I couldn't get a job. Had all kinds of problems. So we have this issue here with women. The struggle overall, I don't care if you're a Hindu, a Buddhist, or whatever, the struggle is against a colonialist system a patriarchal or paternal system. Neither one of being on a pedestal is no great shakes either. As one feminist once said, a pedestal is a very tiny place, and it's a very hard fall when you fall off of the pedestal. So to be, you know, raised to a position of honor in a very restricted atmosphere is no great thing either. And I think this is something we all have in common. And abuse of women is something that is rising, even within the Muslim community, at least within North America. I have heard it addressed, even by Imam Shakir, in khutbahs on a Friday, the issue of, you know, child abuse, rigid discipline, this type of thing. These are issues that are coming up as the society is more strained and trying to, you know, to handle itself in adaptation to this society. So we have very common problems here. And these are issues that all of us have to address, because especially for the Muslim, when we go out or we need assistance or we need counseling or aid, many cases we do not have the Muslim already available, the professional, psychologist, counselor, or whatever that we need. So our ummah, our community, is in a very serious need now to strive to arrange for these things, and we have to work with our Christian counterparts and Jewish counterparts within this country, see how they did it, and be able to provide for ourselves in the same way and to get the aid that we need. These are very major issues, and we cannot do them separately.
You want to make a comment, Melissa?
No, I basically agree, and I guess one of the things I hope would come out of this is not only what I think is happening, or at least speaking for myself, some better understandings of, in sense, in some ways, both Christianity and especially for me, especially Islam. But I would like to see that as a road to how do we confront some issues we share. I mean, and particularly since here we're talking about the treatment of women, how do we confront issues we share around the just treatment of women? And how can we combine resources? See, I think we have some common resources. My guess is, or my insight is, listening to this, that we have some different resources, but that could strengthen the fight.
I'll move to Dr. Moses.
A little testimony here.
I think one area that would help considerably, if there is a little bit of understanding in Western societies to what Islam teaches, and a little bit of education, because to be honest with you, in most of my meetings in the last 25 years, all what I hear all the time is always negative aspect about the cultural aspect of the Arabs or the cultural aspect of the Muslims. And I think Dr. Alawaski brought a very important point, for example, you know, by pointing to the cultural aspect of some Arabian countries, lack of permission for women to drive or to get jobs and things like that. So I think a good starting point would be for us to educate ourselves a little bit better about the history and the culture of the others. Why the Muslims can point to the verses in the Quran, for example, that deals with the equality of the woman, that deals with the special status given to the woman, to the hadith, that puts the woman in a special place, the heavens are under the feet of the Lord. When Muslims study the scriptures in Christianity, they don't see the same thing that the Christians in Western societies try to promote to them. For example, everybody tries to give you always the impression that women in this country have had the right to vote forever, from day one. A woman was treated equally to the men. Up till now, they don't have any form of equality and they have to struggle. When you even look at the scriptures, you will find that the position of the woman is cast in an extremely negative aspect. So Muslims will look at things like that and say, you know, that is a very clever way to turn the table on the Muslims instead of learning also about Islam and their problems.
Thank you, Dr. Hussain. I think we are coming to the end of this part, and we'll have to move to the audience over here. Okay.
Very good.
You know how we
I just want to add three practical suggestions on the question of abuse. Number one, I think many reports seem to indicate that abuse of women and children, for that matter, seem to be very much connected with drinking. And women here does not only mean wife, but even girlfriend. So I think if Muslims and Christians also both work towards that ideal about, you know, reduction of booze. Of course, I'm not saying that Christians should agree with Muslims fully of total dryness, but at least...
You're pointing to an issue.
Exactly, it is an issue. Secondly, I believe the way a person treats others depends on their religious motives. So by proper understanding of either Islam and Christianity, you avoid that because you give a proper motive. And I say proper understanding because some people could make distorted interpretation of text that does not mean at all what they want, and they take it out of context. So it has to be properly understood. Both sides, not sides, I don't like to, this telephone, but like Muslims and Christians alike should try to teach this. Thirdly, I think part of the family violence also may result from the lack of proper family counseling, especially for immigrants who do not have an extended family like they used to have at home. And I believe a great need is there to provide family counseling and help in resolving this problem before it gets too serious.
Thank you. Go ahead.
Somebody. You know, we've been talking a lot about misunderstandings about Islam. I sincerely believe that it doesn't have a whole lot to do with a misunderstanding of the religious principles. I have to say that I think it's economic. The United States government is interested in the oil in the Middle East. There's nothing subtle about the United States government, and therefore it identifies Arabs as Muslims, and therefore you are the bottom of the totem pole. And, you know, there's the collusion of the media and all of these kind of popular things. There is the whole Middle East business, the Palestinian and the Israeli struggle. I do not believe that the Arabs have supported the Palestinians probably in the way they should have. But nevertheless, there is a strong Israeli lobby in this country. So that's another thing. You're identified with the bad guys. And everything I heard you talk about this morning, terrorism, et cetera, that's all a creation of the United States government to take over the resources of the Middle East. So I think, I think this has been wonderful for me and very, I've learned a lot, and I would like to continue this. I think in terms of actually addressing the problem is not religious. There have, you know, to my knowledge, the Muslims and the Jews and the Christians have never fought over religion. It has always been territory or some kind of economic hoo-ha behind it. And we use the banner of religion, and people like, you know, presidents of countries talk about God and country and whatever, and everybody thinks that it's a religious thing. I think we are, in terms of dealing with it, although this is a very healthy and helpful dialogue, this is not going to, I don't think, deal with the problems that you are facing in this country as a group of people that are being badmouthed. The pressures are not coming at you from base intelligent, reasonable Christian people. It is coming to you from an economic and political, geopolitical way, and maybe that would be something that we could talk about someday. You know, how many of us believe the same things about that, and how can we share resources to create some alternative political realities?
So you should respond to her if they want to, though.
Yes,
okay, so this is going back a little bit further, and I agree with you, Jean. I'm Mary Eileen Shield, by the way, for people that don't know me. I teach theology and women's studies here at Loyola, which is a Catholic university, but my classes are very multicultural. I'm excited about this program because we try to do this in my classes in a limited way, and one thing I've found that's been very exciting to me is that I normally will have three or four Muslim women in a class of 30, mostly women, because men still have a barrier in their heads about taking women's studies classes, which they shouldn't. But as we've studied the Gospels and looked for the positive images of women, I think as Christians we use the term discipleship a great deal. We are called to follow Jesus and to try to live according to his teachings. Muslims use the word believers or service of God, you know, and it's the same thing in my mind. But these Muslim girls now are starting to do the same thing and just discover the Quran mostly for the first time. And I've been impressed by Sister Aisha's comments. What's happening now is that their parents are finding their, as they call it, reversion to Islam threatening. They're Muslim. Well, a couple of them wanted to come today, and believe it or not, their Muslim fathers wouldn't allow it because they feel that this is kind of a feminist thing, a rebellion against the family. And so that's just a comment. I don't have an answer. But I grew up in a fundamentalist Christian mode, and I switched to liberal Christianity. That's another solution. Liberal Catholicism, that's an oxymoron, maybe. But anyway, I find it really exciting. And I hope we can, as Dr. Yvonne said, continue to look for the common ground, what our two traditions can do together and separately to affirm the worth of women, scripturally and sociologically. Thank you.
Thank you for your comment. If you have another comment.
My name is Muhammad Sadiq. I'm also very appreciative of the environment and the atmosphere, especially the one that Dr. Haddad is trying to bring about as a way of change. It is definitely a phenomenon. I see a panel of distinguished scholars and speakers who are addressing each other by brother and sister, even though they might have not seen each other before. And that definitely is a step in the right direction. I know that this is very unpopular when we step outside the door here, but I hope that this will be a beginning for common work. I have a point that I wanted to bring. We have addressed issues related to women in the scriptures and women being denied their rights in various cultural backgrounds and historical contexts, both in the Middle East and in the Far East and elsewhere. There is also a common problem that I think is also equally relevant, that is the Western women situation, and that might have been touched on also. And I believe that this is an issue that both, or maybe even all religious communities, those who have a commitment to faith, should be addressing, especially those who are living in the West. So Muslims in the West, as well as Christians in the West, should try to define the problem. I think the problem is probably even well defined. Women, just to shed some light, are not getting equal pay for equal work. The abuse of women is statistically staggering. Murder rate of women by husbands and boyfriends is equal to once every 1.5 hours. And a host of other statistics that are very frightening. So we do have a common problem, both being in the West, both having a commitment to faith, to correcting that which is wrong. And maybe that would be an issue that we all need to try to bring about and address. And I would like to hear from you whether, in fact, there are evidence to scripturally based solutions to these problems in the Western society. Thank you.
Can we hear from any of you? Can you repeat the question? Just specifically.
The question would be, are there any scriptural solutions to the specific problems of women in the West, both from the Muslim and the Christian side?
I'm not going to get into like scriptural solutions per se. I think, again, education as to what is meant by women's equality, what is meant by equity, identity of treatment, simply the right to humane behavior on the part of the spouse and employer or anyone else. This is not just, you know, scripturally based, whether it's biblical or it's Quranic or it's based on the Torah. Hasn't very much to do with it. We've already determined that the problem is not whether it's Christian West or Islamic East or Shinto Japan. The point is that over the world in general, women are mistreated and abused, in many cases out of alcohol. This is one of the big problems, but also out of ignorance, out of fear that the espousal of women's rights, the right to speak, would, and the right to think and to be educated, may, quote, lead her astray or give her, as my grandfather used to say, big ideas. these things are fears that are very common the world over as far as men are concerned. I think this is education. We have to talk to each other what our expectations are, male and female, Christian, Jew, and Muslim, and proceed from a common objective of some sort to correct the problem. We can't all be going at the problem from different directions.
I think in the question and answer period, I'd like you not to exceed 1 minute and the answer for everybody over here. So please stick to that guidance. Please go ahead.
Well, it struck me that at least one of the themes that both of us have talked about has been the theme of equality, and its grounding in some ways in Quranic and biblical scriptures. And the argument I would make is that the reason it's important is because the alternative, a subordinationist view of the relation of women to men, has justified, has given rationalization to abuse, to this notion that this is in the name of the discipline of the insubordinate. I also think the other issue at heart in this is violence itself and is the assumption that violence is an appropriate way to solve problems. This is a serious matter in the United States. Even the best films about Amish families. What was that? The movie
right.
Witness?
Right.
Witness? I mean, this is a movie about an Amish family where the heart of Amish life is nonviolence, but finally violence is trumped. What's his name? You can tell how often I see movies.
I don't hear it.
Harrison Ford leaps out of the buggy of the Amish and batters this bully into the ground. For us, it's in a cultural set of assumptions that's very deeply ingrained. I do think we can probably both talk about some grounds for treatment on some other grounds. We've talked about human rights this morning. Certainly, biblical notions of Salem, of Shalom, give us an alternative.
Thank you. If you have something and you can't wait, just go ahead, but I'd like
Sorry.
You to wait. Okay,
good.
I'm Yusuf Azmi from Osmania University, India. In this session, the whole discussion was very interesting, informative, reflecting many aspects. And as Ivan Haddad has questioned the very philosophy of this dialogue, I subscribe to that view that she tells them and some kind of comfortable to be classified in a different way. So the commonality of approach is very important. The issue, space, rather than the whole map in a different way, of sometimes even to the extent of confrontation, giving some sources from this and other things. The issues and the commonality are important. I think some changes ought to be made in the whole process of dialogue and other things. The question by Brother John and the answers of Sister Aisha and Dr. Jamal Badawi with reference to the Islamic position. And it's very clear, they have made very clear that Islam has given a clear cut equity and the very image of libas, equality is there. But the one thing, the question that was raised, when in abstract term Islam gives equality and equity and other things, but in reality definitely there are certain whether they are cultural constraints, I do not say that it is only cultural content. I may disagree partly with Dr. Jamal Badawi, but the wrong interpretation of Islamic injunctions also. The ulama, by virtue of their conservatism and the personal reasons, you can see some of the institutions in the Western countries where Muslims in a very free atmosphere, where the cultural constraints or the political, socio-political constraints are not there, as you find it has been a process in Pakistan also when electing the women prime minister or other things. So the constraints and the interpretations are also there in addition to the cultural constraints. So when these interpretation, dogmatic interpretation and cultural and socio-political all go together to bring a new kind of enlightenment to the position of women given by Islam and gave the model in real Prophet's life, And as you have given the situation that earlier anthropological studies showed that how women were treated badly in Islam, give them it, and these are things to be considered, mm-hmm. and perhaps in commonality.
Thank you. That was a comment.
Please.
My name is Rick Bailey, and I'd like to follow up on one thing that the Muslim brother over here said about there probably is no totally Christian or Muslim society out there today that's fully practicing what each religion teaches, and that there's actually a lot of other forces out there. Secularism, I think, is the one you mentioned. I'm curious to know what percentage or to what degree do you think the women's movement of the last 100 years or so is a non-religious movement that is secular, and to what degree is it? And to what degree are Christians and Muslims just interacting with that, trying to fit into it, and to what degree is it really a religious kind of reaction?
Yeah, and I'd like you also to add to that how much the society is affected by the scriptures. It's going in the same line, and we had it, and we forgot to write it down.
What did you just ask?
How much the scriptures are affecting the society? Are they changing? Are they doing anything in the society? Or are they just there?
Can I answer that?
Yes, go ahead.
I want to answer his question, too.
Sure.
I don't know that... Probably, I can't speak for Islam, because one of the things I've learned this afternoon is that you are greatly affected by the written word and by the scriptures. So I don't know. But I think quite possibly in Christianity, it doesn't matter what's written. If people aren't living something out in some way, then it doesn't take hold in this society. I mean, I think that behavior, that ideas follow behavior in this society, that people have an experience and then they learn something and then they do something else. So, I think that we could talk about the ideals and the written word a million times, but until there is some experiential interaction with that, I don't know that in Western society, because we are such a visual and an audio society. But the other gentleman's question about how much of the women's movement is religious, that question just threw me. I mean, women... The number of women that are religious, to however they define that, and or that have an ideology or whatever, that are participating in that, would be that statistic. But it's a different way. I don't look at people. I don't look at religion as separate from political involvement, as separate from. I mean, I just don't see pieces of it like that. So I don't see the movement like that. I believe that everybody is religious. Now, what they believe, you know, and what they worship and what they may be different from me, but every living human being has something about them transcends. It has to. So I would have to say that the whole women's movement is religious. Now, how much of it is formally identified as religion, I don't know.
Go ahead.
I cannot give the statistics either, but there are a number of things that might be useful to remember. One is that in recent decades we find that a lot of very highly respected scholars like Ghazali and Qaradawi and others keep writing and lecturing about those issues quite extensively, and they seem to get lots of following. I'm not saying that all women's movements in the Muslim world are religious. Some trends are totally secularistic, there's no question about that. But they have tremendous influence. I'll give you a couple of incidents that seem to indicate this. In one conference, right here in the United States, when the organizers were too strict, many of them came from the Gulf area, and tried to have the lecture for women separate from men. It was one of those great scholars, Dr. Qaradawi himself, I heard, he led women, he said, come with me, and he led them, in spite of the opinion of the organizers, brought them to the public lecture in that particular section so that they be part of the discussion. I have seen also some even... Surprisingly, Saudi women who have very open and very, enlightened understanding of Islam, even though sometimes they are under pressure when they go home to behave in certain ways. And that seems to indicate there is some movement also that is under the surface. So they seem to, in one city here in North America, without specifying the place, the people who are in charge of the mosque or Islamic Center seem again to be largely and predominantly from this very conservative type of trend or conviction. And as a result, the sister could not really have free access to the masjid to have their activities. One sister started a session or a group of three people. Now she wrote to me the other day that she's got 60 or 70 women. Some of them are Americans who accepted Islam, sir, come from Muslim countries, and they're meeting regularly. So I can see that in many masjids where there is this sometimes struggle between these two mentalities, that I would conclude with a very great deal of caution that there seems to be a great deal of movement along the side of Islam without necessarily saying that the solution is to secularize wholesale as some did in the past.
Okay, you have a comment.
Talking about the violence against women or children, I believe that talking about violence against women or children, whether it is in the West or in the East, I believe that we must admit that the percentage of people who are learned in their own religion is quite very minimal, and the percentage of that minimal percentage who apply what they learn is very also minimal. So this is how much you can relate violence at home, domestic violence, to any religion anyway. Let alone that the secular educational system does not provide enough remedies, if at all, to bring about a cohesive understanding between men and women, between young boys and young girls. They are always portrayed to each other in a physical form rather than a spiritual human form, to exchange ideas, to be able to resolve conflicts by talking, by discussion, by counseling. So those approaches only came as a late remedy for an old disease that was not prevented from the beginning. It is not something that came because of religion. It is not something that the society promoted. It is something that came because something was not done, which is education. The inappropriate format of men relating to women, or adults relating to children, or the fights with the teenagers and the adults, all of that is an area that Muslims, Christians, and Jews are failing to address. And I'm saying it with a full mouth because it is a very, very serious problem. And while all of us complain that the youth are running away from religion, that the girls are running away from religion, and so on and so forth, we are driving them away, number one, by not educating them about it, number two, by failing ourselves as adults or educators to address these problems openly with our children, with our neighbors, with our church members, to bring about proper education, proper treatment for cases of severe violence.
Can we come to the end of this one?
Excuse me?
Can you finish it up to
this point? I'm finished.
Okay.
My name is Vern Rock, and I have a specific question I'm kind of embarrassed to ask because it may be my hearing, but I don't want to go away with any misunderstandings. Mrs. Bay, in your opening remarks, you spoke quite a bit about the beginnings of Islam. And I think I heard you say this, and I just want to verify it because it's something new to me. But I think you spoke of several thousand women scholars and jurists, and you referred this to Umar several times. So I would rather imagine that you're speaking of the four Orthodox caliphs during that period. Are you referring to Arabia? This is something completely new to me, that there's that many women scholars and jurists in Arabia. I understood that Islam came out of the Jahiliyyah. And that being the case, I just haven't heard this before. And if this is correct, I would like information where I could read that and study that myself.
When I talk about the early days of Islam, generally I think most scholars put those early days within the days of the Sahaba, the first four caliphs, and shortly thereafter. Because if you look at the history of the spread of Islam, it had spread completely through the continent of India within less than 100 years from the time of the death of the Prophet, peace be upon him. So within those early days, yes, there were a conservative estimate that I've read from Muslim scholars places the figure of women poets, transmitters of hadith, jurists, and other educated women at approximately 2,500. And I don't believe that this is a terribly overrated estimate. There were quite a few. You have to remember, even in the Jahiliyyah, for the Arab, poetry is a very particular form of expression, always has been. And the Quran, when recited, which I can't do, is an incredibly beautiful poetic experience. There have been many, many poets, men and women, in Arabia in the time of Jahiliyyah and as far back as Arabia. But this is within Arabia and within the early region of the spread of Islam. Yes, there are quite a few. There are a number of books about Muslim women that are available. If you check the catalog from Qazi Publications out here, there are at least 20 to 30 books of Muslim women and scholars. Volume 5 of the Encyclopedia of Sirah, which is published in, I think it's 7 full volumes. Volume 5 is devoted entirely to women with names and lists and all types of things of their early activities. There is quite a bit printed now.
I think maybe this then is just a misunderstanding of terms. When anybody uses the term scholar, that has one connotation. I would agree with you if you mentioned poets, because I think some of the great poets of that time were actually illiterate. You don't have to be literate to be particularly a poet. And I think I just misunderstood what you were saying by that many scholars, and I had thought you meant they were in Arabia. Now, it is very possible that there were educated people that accepted Islam as they came out of Arabia, that were educated, that were scholars in other countries. But this was something that I just did not place as being the condition of Arabia at the time of you mentioned Umar several times. But there again, I think it's just a misunderstanding. I would have completely understood if you had said poets. But
well,
scholars
it isn't
and
just
poets.
Poet. I am talking also about scholars, jurists, people who issued certificates to the great jurists and teachers like al-Shafi and Malik and others. And this was done comparatively early, and I think you should look at context. We're talking about the 7th century A.D. as far as Christian dating. Even right now.
She gave many.
Hafsa, I gave some during the address. Hafsa, wife of... Yeah, please.
I just give you one example that really is quite revealing. One of the great early scholars of Islam, a male by the name of Abu Musa al-Ash'ari, once made a statement about Aisha, the wife of the Prophet. Mm-hmm. And he said, whenever we here is not the common man, we the big scholars, whenever we as scholars had any dispute about any matter of jurisprudence, we used to go to Aisha and we always, his words, we always found that she had knowledge of it. So the big scholars are going to Aisha to inquire about certain verdicts.
Well, thank you very much, and we come to the end of the session. We'll be ready, hopefully, in the next few minutes for the second session, which will start at 6 o'clock. And most probably, we'll have to do some checks, but most probably we'll do it upstairs instead of this place. So we'll let you know in a few minutes. Supposed to have this place for another group at 8 o'clock, so we'll see if we can finish before that, or we have to move the room.
Hamid, yeah. Thank you. Sure, thank you very much.
Okay, there is a suggestion that we start in 15 minutes and then we stay in this room. Can we do that? Please raise your hands who can. Okay, good. Then we'll start 15 minutes from now at this place. And we'll finish early so that the other people can use the room.
Will we be finished by 8 o'clock?
We'll also be finished. We'll finish by 4 o'clock.
Oh, yeah, I'm a little
clear.
Say the coin.
Are you a Kuwaiti?
No, I just was thinking how I guess it was our religious duty to go save the Kuwaiti.